This is CliffCentral.com.
CliffCentral.com on a Thursday morning. Thursdays are great because you get the Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's. It's our look at current affairs, all the things that are going on in the news. And this morning, we're very, very lucky to be joined by Davie Schultz. He is on Skype from London to talk to us this morning. The reason we want to talk to him is because he is News 24's elections analyst. That's not his full-time job, though. He's actually a high finance guy. He's a consultant at the Boston Consulting Group. He's established himself as one of the more considered analysts traversing the minefield of political analysis. He's attracted a huge Twitter following. I started following him about 3 or 4 years ago, I think, for his incisive dissection of political shifts and electoral tumult. He's also one of the few analysts around who keep a close eye on by-elections and on what they signal about changing voting patterns and perceptions. So I don't know if you saw this, but the latest polling numbers released by the Institute of Race Relations say that there's a bit of a bombshell on the way. The think tank's research showing the governing party could be in danger of losing an outright majority. Well, while that is in dispute, Davie recently took a look at the polling numbers and has his own take on those analyses, or rather, on the numbers that he's been looking at. And he joins us this morning via Skype from London to discuss it. So, Davie, good morning, and thanks for making some time for us.
Good morning, guys, and I believe that his birthday is in order. It's 5 years, right?
That's
one full election cycle. So great.
Yeah, thank you very much, Davie. Yeah, we turned 5 yesterday, and as you say, that's an election cycle in South Africa. So let's get into this, because next week, this time, we'll have results in from the elections, and obviously, you are the kind of person who will be paying attention to this in advance. You also are the kind of person who's not afraid of taking the time to make some predictions. So let's start with voter turnout, because I've seen a couple of polls that show some breakdowns around voter turnout, and particularly around young people turning out at the polls. If more people come, who does that favor? If less people come, who does that favor?
So the more people, less people conundrum, I don't think is actually the right way to think about this if you're trying to figure out about the turnout in our own neutral favor. The more important thing is really the who turns out. So, you know, if it's 75% and suburban turnout is significantly higher than township turnout, then it's going to favor the DA. If it's 70% and the balance between suburban areas and townships are one way or another, then it's going to favor the party that benefits from having more of its core voters turn out. So it's not so much about 75%, 75%, it's more about how the 70% is built. So, I mean, just to answer the first question, it seems that the expectation is something like 71-72%, so close to the previous election, but maybe a little bit less. But the more important question is, how is that 71-72% built up? And does one of the parties get what they call a differential turnout? So having its core supporters turn out disproportionately more than the other party's supporters, which illustrates, you know, support. And I think that's one of the critical variables in this election that no one really knows about at this stage. The pollsters kind of seem to, in the numbers, have an implicit assumption that suburban turnout is going to be a little bit higher than township turnout, like it was in the previous election. But I think we have very little hard data at this stage to actually be able to say how that's going to work out.
When you look around South Africa and you see how many posters there are and how much electioneering is going on and how people are having rallies and all kinds of other things, does it feel, to me it certainly it feels like a normal election, but is it a normal election? Are the stakes any higher? Are the politicians putting in any extra effort? Which parties are and which parties aren't? I mean, you look at the statistics, so you're not basing this on feelings like people like Pumi and I might. What do you read from the terrain as we approach the election?
So I think the one statistical piece of evidence that we have about this is the amount of people that registered on the registration weekends that happened in the last couple of months before the election. And that number is significantly down. So I think that's the one little red flag that you have to suggest that maybe actually there's not that much intent turnout out there or the intent interest as there was in previous elections. That's the one thing. The other thing that you also have is like this long-term historic trend of turnout reducing in elections over time in South Africa. So ever since 1994, turnout has actually been steadily coming down in all of the elections. That's why the expression is hopefully a little bit lower this year as well. But then just, as you said, talking anecdotally and thinking about the country a little bit, it feels like a normal election campaign, right? We have big rallies, we have lots of posters, lots of people talking about it, lots of activity on social media. But I think there's one kind of quantitative fact which isn't really factored into that, and that is the number of people that are turned off by all the parties. And I think the number of people that are turned off by all the parties is actually at an historic high. So there's if you look at the polling, there's larger contingent of undecided voters later in the campaign, and more don't knows or don't want to give an answer to the question what they're going to vote for than usual. And it kind of implies to me that there's a group of South Africans who are unhappy with kind of all the parties and kind of aren't sure whether they're going to vote and aren't sure who they're going to vote yet. So that's why I think this was quite a little bit more of a dynamic end game to this campaign than we usually have. So usually by now we have a very clear view of what the election outcome is going to be, to be honest, with like a couple of percentage points, you know, up or down maybe here or there, and parties are just trying to turn out their base. But I actually think in this campaign there's something interesting happening in that there are more undecided at the end. The parties are not just focusing on turnout, they're actually trying to do persuasion for undecided voters as well at this stage, which is interesting and a bit different.
Davi, it's Pumi. I am very interested in your statistics, and I've been looking at the numbers that you've been putting out over the past couple of weeks. And the IRR took out their numbers a couple of days ago. And you don't agree on the ANC kind of numbers, but you do agree on the turnout for the DA. And it's slightly lower than what they think it is. Why is it so low? I mean, you're talking about if there's a higher turnout, they maybe go higher, but it's still significantly low. I mean, it's dropping to between 20 and 25 in your numbers and between 21 and 24 in the IRR's numbers.
So this is a quite complicated question, so I'm going to give you a long answer. but the question about election expectations, I think, unfortunately, the answer right now is quite complex. And I think there's kind of one of two answers. And the other thing I think before we just get into that, so is that I think the right election to compare results to is actually the 2014 national government election. So I think in your question, it's sort of implicit that, you know, if the DA gets between 20 and 25, they'll be down because they got 27% in the 2016 local government election, right? But I'm not quite sure that it's the right election to compare it to, because turnout patterns are totally different in local government elections, and the kind of issues at stake are a bit different in local government elections. So I would think that the right one to compare it to is the previous national government election, which was in 2014, when the DA won 22% of the vote, the ANC got 62%, and the EFF got 6.6% of the vote. And I think that's the kind of key marker in the ground to look at. But then turning to expectations for this election. So what I've done is I've analyzed, I've got what you would call a demographic model. So I've basically looked at all of the demographic groups in South Africa. I've taken a full electorate and broken it up into the different demographic groups and looked at the turnout and voting patterns within those different demographic groups over time, and kind of tried to do a rational projection based on by-elections, previous election results and so on, and what each demographic group will do on the 8th of May. And it looks, if I look at that sort of historic data, it looks like the sort of election where the DA is going to get something like 23 or 24% of the vote, and the ANC is going to get something like 58 or 59 or 57% of the vote. So that's 55 to 60 kind of range. But maybe with a bias to a little bit higher than 50s. So that in my view, is the fundamental kind of underlying expectation for the election. Now, the only problem is that is based on historic data and by-elections, and the by-elections stopped about a month ago. So we haven't had any fresh data to input into this model for the last month. And ever since the last by-elections, when it's kind of the last point where I could form my view of the election, we've had some pretty radical polling data from a number of pollsters. So we've actually had some people putting it at the really high end for the ANC, right? Like Ipsos, who has it at something like 61 or 62% for the ANC. There were one or two other lesser-known pollsters also had it around there. But then we have the Institute of Race Relations now coming out to the ANC at 51%, right? And that's a really radically low number. And to be perfectly honest with you, you know, it's impossible for me to externally validate whether these polls are right or wrong at this stage, because there's just no other live data to look at. So at this stage, we're a little bit flying blind. The only thing I'll say is, you know, my fundamental view of 55 to 60, I think, is a starting point for this election. And what I know from the demographic analysis is that it will take something very extraordinary and radical for you know, that not to happen. So for the ANC to get up to 61 or 62, they have to do exceptionally well and much, much better than the 2016 local government election, voting pattern. And then for the ANC to get under 50, it would require a 55, it would require, you know, a really significant shift, particularly in the black electorate, you know, places like Soweto, LAX, Ipswich, these kind of core, ANC support areas in places like Gauteng. You know, there's got to be a really big swing away from the ANC for that to materialize. And, you know, it could be happening on the campaign trail right now without us actually knowing it. We'll see on the 8th of May. But I still think that the kind of fundamental view of this election is something like 55 to 60 for the ANC, 20 to 25 for the DA. So a kind of election outcome that has the EFF doing quite a lot better, so something like 10 or 11, the ANC kind of losing some support. And the DA is stagnating or maybe growing like by a percentage point or two, basically. That is, I think, the most likely outcome, so given everything we've seen.
Now, Davi, what about the provinces? Because this is a national election, but it's also a provincial election. And there's quite a lot of, mm-hmm. of contestation going mm-hmm. on in places like Limpopo, places like Gauteng, and even, I suppose, you could call in like parts of KwaZulu-Natal too, which are fractious, to say the least.
Yeah.
What do you reckon is going to happen there, or is it going to be exactly the same as it was in the last election?
No, look, it's definitely not, right? Like, these swings are often national. So if we're talking about the ANC losing, like, 5 or 6% percentage points nationally, it's going to bleed into all of the provinces, right? And then there are going to be interesting consequences in different places, because it's not going to be a uniform, you know, -6 ANC everywhere. Somewhere the ANC will be down further, and somewhere they'll actually be up, and it'll be an interesting election because of that. But I think the most interesting provinces to look at is the first place to start, which is Gauteng. You know, in the 2016 election, they got under 50% in Gauteng. Like, you can't just look at it that way, but you can use that data point in an intelligent way. And if you do, it kind of suggests that the starting point of this election for the ANC is about 48-49% in Gauteng. So, you know, depending on how things are going on the campaign trail, I think it's going to be very close between the ANC and 50 in Gauteng this year. So every single vote will matter, and that, I think, is going to be a very, very interesting election to watch, is the Gauteng provincial election. The other one that I think surprisingly interesting, specifically because of the polling that's come out recently, is the Western Cape. So in my model, I kind of felt quite confident that the DA would get something like 53 or 54%, so, you know, a smaller majority, but maintain the Western Cape in the election. But polling seems to put it at, like, you know, 51-50% with IRR, and some of the other guys have it even lower than that. So it looks like the Western Cape could actually also be potentially a race for the DA, but let's wait and see. And then I think there are kind of two sleeper provinces that that haven't really popped up on everyone's radar just yet, but I think it will be interesting on election night. And the one is Northern Cape. The polling coming out of the Northern Cape is very just unreliable, because it's such a rural province. There are a lot of people living in little hamlets where, you know, the signal is really bad and contributing to the polling and so on. And it's difficult to poll, but from the little bit of polling that's come from there, it just looks like the Northern Cape could be competitive, or at least the ANC could suffer significant losses in the Northern Cape. And then I think the other one, which is extremely interesting, is KZN. And because, you know, KZN is huge, but has a lot of, you know, complex and divergent trends taking place there. The kind of, particularly in the black electors in Gauteng, sorry, in KZN, there are kind of three sub-pools. There's the one, which is the kind of northern KZN, old city land, where the NSP and the IFP does pretty well, and from by-elections, it seems that they are going to do okay in this election, maybe take a little bit from the ANC. Then you have kind of urban KZN, which is Ekurhuleni, Durban, and Peter Maritzburg, and so on, with very large population centers, very large townships, where the EFF seems to be making very significant inroads in those areas. And then kind of southern KZN, which is traditionally a very strong ANC area, like lots of turnout, lots of really strong support, particularly for Jacob Zuma. And still on the border with approval, I think it's just really low in that part of the country. So it'll be interesting to see what impact that has. And I think the net effect of all of those things is that the ANC is probably going to come in a little bit softer in KZN, The question is just exactly how much softer, and unfortunately, the answer is I don't really know. But I think it's going to be one to watch an election night. And then you did also mention Limpopo, which I actually think will be interesting in its own way, because Julius Malema is obviously from Limpopo, very, very popular in Limpopo, and did very well there in 2016. But now Cyril Ramaphosa is leading up the ANC, and it's also from Limpopo, and I think it will be an interesting tussle to see if the EFF can maintain or grow its support in Limpopo, given that Cyril Ramaphosa is from there and very, very popular from there. And I think that will also be quite important for the national number, because it's a very large pool of votes, and a couple of percentage points swing here or there could actually change the national result a little bit.
Davi, you know, we're talking a lot about kind of very low turnouts, and to do anything, especially in the provincial space, it looks like everybody's going to have to go into some kind of coalition, or at least the politicking to get things pushed and happening is going to have to be coalitions. Now, the DA has gone with a very interesting stance in terms of all of their campaigning. When I see in these main roads here in Joburg, they've stopped giving any kind of a care. You know, they've just got posters up that just say stop ANC and EFF. And I'm wondering how that will impact them in places like where, especially in the metros, they've had coalitions with the EFF. And they're going to need coalitions. They're obviously going to need coalitions, but this is their campaign slogan. How will that impact how their voters respond to their campaigning at the moment?
Yeah, I think that the one point to make is that before elections and after elections are two very, very different things of coalition discussions, and I think the parties are all kind of slightly cynical enough, but also mature enough to understand that campaigning takes place in a particular way, and coalition negotiations take place in a particular way. And so I don't, to be honest, buy any coalition talk before an election that says, you know, we won't work with this party or we will work with this party or whatever. I think the parties say what they need to say before the election. But I do think it merits just discussing that poster, because it's a very interesting poster. And it's that the one that says, the DA poster that says stop ANC and EFF. And I think to me, it implies something about what's happening with the DA's election campaign. It feels to me like the DA, if I look at by-election results and just a little bit of what they've been doing in the last couple of weeks, are working really, really hard to try to win white voters, which is surprising, right? Because in past elections, they've really just had white voters sewn up, like a really high percentage of white voters just automatically almost vote DA. But they're doing things like putting up that poster and, you know, running out someone like Tony Leon to be front and center in a place like Gauteng quite late in the campaign. This suggests to me that they're a little bit below their targets, probably on their internal polling on white voters, and they're, I guess, trying to regain some of their traditional base, because in recent by-elections, we've seen quite a lot of conservative white voters, Afrikaans voters, going over from the DA to the Team Front Plus, and so I think, you know, if they're losing, like, in some of these by-elections, as many as 20%, right, and that would have a significant impact on their national number, and I think part of their campaign, certainly not the full focus of their campaign, but there's a kind of part of their campaign of just trying to win back those voters. And I think that's what that larger sense of that poster was about.
Davi, you talk about the white vote, for whatever it's worth. What do you think the effect of smaller parties might be? We hear often about COPE and Bantolomisa's UDM, and we hear about new entries into the market for that vote. Do you think that there are any new parties that could inspire a movement to the polls that we haven't seen before in terms of a significant showing?
In the white elections, I personally don't buy the idea that the COPE or the UDM is going to stick very well. I think there's probably some chance for the ANC to do a little bit better, but only marginally. I think the real threat for the DA and the white elections is Freedom Front Plus and more conservative voters. I also don't by the kind of purple cow argument, or there's very little evidence of that in other polling. They haven't contested any by-elections, so it would have to be quite a big surprise for them to do particularly well, or any of the other kind of smaller parties that are trying to get into that particular portion of the electorate. The one new party that I do think is going to be quite impactful is actually going to be the ATM, the African Transformation Movement. Jimmy Mani, well, it's not the Mani's party, but the party in which Jimmy Mani is very heavily involved.
Wow.
Is, I think if you look at some of the by-elections that they've competed in, are actually doing quite well on the ground. If you look at the events they're hosting, quite a lot of people there. That's my dark horse pick for a surprise of the election. You know, I don't think it matters, but if they win a couple of percentage points all out of the ANC, I think that could have a distorting impact on the election. That's a bit of a surprise. I think the other one which is to watch is just good, right? Because the Royals Party, I don't think there's any chance of sort of significant national numbers for them, but the impact they could have is in the Western Cape, right? And particularly in the kind of electorate in the Western Cape, and how much exactly they take there is probably a crucial variable on whether the DA manages to hold on to 50 in the Western Cape or not. I think they have very little data to say exactly what the impact will be. My sense is not huge, but maybe if it's a close election, you know, enough to be impactful.
So there are these three polls that we can rely on at the moment, and they all have very different numbers. Ipsos, you mentioned, and the IRR, and also Mark Data. Now, I'm curious about what happens. You know, the ANC usually have a push towards the end, like the day before. I think Saturday they're having their big Siyangqoba rally, and those usually add a few numbers to the support base. There are predictions of a total collapse in the black vote for the ANC, but I think those are probably unfounded. What do you reckon? Any other events or significant occurrences might be in the next couple of days that could swing a few percentage points to one or two of the parties? Are there any massive impacts that could occur that could change things significantly in the last week before elections?
Look, I think there are probably two topics that can affect elections in the last week. Let's call it three. So the one is just it's a contextual issue. If there are more corruption things that come up, right? So if it's the whole conversation for the next 5 days is just about corruption and state capture and, you know, whatever ACE did were, or, you know, various basically bad things for the ANC, then I think that probably numbs a little bit of this final, what they call the squeeze, right? And lock up with the ANC usually arrives, picks up a couple of points of support, and that could dull it a little bit. We'll have to see exactly how much, but so that's one potential thing. I think the other thing is just, you know, if the ANC, a critical variable for me is whether the ANC is going to go on the attack in the next 5 days, or if they're just going to continue with the current sort of new dawn messaging, which is all very positive and nice, and which basically says, you know, we frankly screwed up, but we're trying to fix it now. Please give us another chance. But, you know, it's the Siyangqoba rally is all about that. I think it has a different impact than the Siyangqoba rally that's all about, you know, attacking the DA, attacking the EFF, and being really, really hard. And my current read of the situation is that actually the ANC would be better served by going negative. But my sense is they're actually going to stay positive. So I think that's the one thing that may affect things a little bit. And then I think the other big variable is just whether everyone manages to pull off their rallies very well, right? So the DA has a big rally on Saturday, and then actually the ANC one is on Sunday there. Both the ANC and the EFF both have big rallies on Sunday. And by the way, that's also the one new development in our politics which changes this little final push towards the elections a little bit, in that both the EFF and the ANC have the rallies at the same time on Sunday, so it kind of closes the space a little bit for the ANC to get full attention to its rally. And I think this year as well, the ANC rally isn't going to be at F&B Stadium, it's going to be at Ellis Park. So just from, and I think the EFF rally will be at Orlando Stadium.
Yeah.
So just from a visuals perspective, we're going to have two rallies equal in size, you know? It's not going to be the normal situation where the ANC has a 100,000 person rally, which is just totally dominant on Sunday. So I still prescribe, I think you're right, to the theory that the ANC will pick up a couple of percentage points in the next 2 days. But I also just get the sense that it's not going to be as significant in the past. And I will say one more thing about that as well, is that, you know, if you look at the, for example, the black voting pattern in Gauteng, in 2011, the ANC won 87% of black voters in Gauteng. In 2014, they were down to 78%. In 2016, they were down to 69, right? So they went from 87 in 2011 to 69 in 2016. In a five-year period, they lost 18% of the black vote in housing. Now, I think what that also means on the ground is that there are just more people who disagree with the ANC, right? So when, and I think what you see internationally in elections is this coalescing effect, the squeeze, where people sort of turn to the largest party, happens in populations where a particular party is very dominant. But as the party's dominance wanes, its ability to squeeze out support in those last couple of days is diminished. Now, the ANC is dominant, so I think they will get it, but this was a very long way to just say, I think, to a lesser extent than usual. And we're going to see very clearly on the 9th of May exactly where they end up at.
Davi, the ANC also had, in the past couple of weeks, some international kind of support with two big stories coming out last week in the New York Times, I think, and in The Economist. All saying, Cyril Ramaphosa is the way to go.
Yeah, then let's be clear. The Economist said that it was a rotten party, but that the leader of the party was a good guy.
And so there's an opportunity for him to pull this thing through, but that South Africa as a whole would do well to back this man. Do you think that has had any kind of movement on the dial for the ANC?
No, but the one thing I will say is I think it's a marginal counter-endorsement, to be honest, in South Africa. You know, the EFF is out in rural South Africa talking about radical economic transformation, talking about land, talking about our land and jobs now. In that context, to have, you know, quite neoliberal publications endorsing you and talking about how great you're going to be with your free market reforms in South Africa and how you're going to strengthen property rights and all these other things, I'm not sure it's electorally helpful, to be entirely honest. So I think it's probably electorally helpful a little bit, like in the white electorate and so on. So, you know, the ANC is steady targeting to get a little bit more of the white vote and so on. But, you know, that's just at the margin. You know, the difference between 4 and 8% in the white vote is like 0.2 or 0.3% of the overall electorate. The bigger question is, you know, people out there in like Limpopo who feel economically marginalized and who have always been voting ANC because they believe the ANC is the best vehicle for their empowerment, for transforming the economy, who are now kind of maybe thinking about going EFF or maybe even BA, and they see this. I'm not sure it actually helps the ANC in that portion of the electorate, to be honest. So the answer is no, I don't think it's affected the election very much. And in fact, I think it is more of a risk for the ANC than a benefit.
All right, just finally, to wrap this up, because you're the election nerd. I'm going to be watching and listening to your coverage more than anyone else's. And as that stuff starts to trickle in, how will the ANC, EFF, and DA measure success? If you said already that the ANC would be very, very fortunate to get 61% or more, would 61 be a good result for them?
Yeah.
If so, what would be a good result for the EFF, and what would the DA consider success?
That's a great question. So, look, I think the ANC, you know, if they hit 60%, that is a huge success, right? Remember, they did get 54% in the local government election. If you rerun those numbers with national government assumptions built into it, then it's 56 or 57. So, so that's their starting point. If they get to 60, I think it'd be huge. So that, to me, is the number. And the other thing is also just, does the ANC hold Gauteng, right? And all the other provinces. So I think those are the two things. If the ANC holds Gauteng, gets 60% plus, I would say massive success for them. You know, not achieving those two things, depending to the extent which it's the case, will be bad. So if, you know, if they're 49, 48 in Gauteng, they can probably get a coalition together with one of the smaller parties. But if they end up with like 45% in Gauteng and, you know, 55, 56 or something, even closer to what the IOR is saying, that's disastrous, right? And I think that could actually have internal consequences for the ANC. So that's the one party. Then I think the DA, you know, so 22% is the red line for me. If they go between or below 22%, then it's a bad election. And I think then there's going to be an internal leadership discussion in the DA, quite likely. But, you know, if they get what I think is likely, which is 23 or 24, or, you know, outside chance 25, then it it's not a brilliant election, but maybe it's an okay election to keep going, particularly given the tough context I had in 2018 with the digital law and all that other issues. So maybe if they get something like 22, 23, 24, 25, they get to keep going and fight on for the local government election in 2021, which will be more favorable to them in any case. And I guess exactly the same point about Gauteng as well. If the ANC comes in below 50, that'll be very helpful for the DA, I think. And then from the ESS perspective, look, they got 6.6 last time. The feeling is obviously more, right? But we just don't know exactly how much more. By-election starting suggests 9 to 12. I think if they get like 10, that's a pretty good election. But if we get to the 12, 13, 14 level, that's blowing the lights out. I think then the ESS is doing exceptionally well. And also then they're going to be in the kingmaker position in at least Gauteng and potentially even more provinces, which will be very exciting for them. So that's what I'm kind of my markers. But I think the one thing that I also want to say when we're watching the results on election night is just watch very closely how are those voting stations performing where, you know, traditional strong ANC areas where they've just been very dominant for the last 25 years. So like Soweto, right? And as I've just sketched, they went from 87 to 69% from 2011 to 2016. This is how the next election. Are they going to be more than 69 or are they going to be less than 69? And more than 69 would suggest that Cyril Ramaphosa has actually managed to rejuvenate the party to some extent and reverse some of the losses. If they come in under 69, to me, it will signal that the losses are structural and that we are in a structural kind of trend against the ANC in South Africa. Because, even with someone who is as popular as Cyril Ramaphosa, to have further losses beyond the 2016 level to me would be a dangerous sign for the ANC. Not in this election necessarily, but it's for the longer term trend of where the ANC is going. I think that would be a risk factor.
Wow. All right. Well, Davi, listen, you've given us plenty of food for thought. There's lots to get stuck into here, and I'm sure that your week next week is going to be incredibly busy. So thanks for making some time for us today. If you want to know more, you can obviously follow Davi on Twitter. That's the best way to go because he is constantly putting up really, really interesting and reliable information there, which I think a lot of us would like to have. You never really know who to believe. You never know what polls to take seriously. Polls didn't manage to predict Brexit. They didn't manage to predict Trump. So who knows? We might be in for some surprises next week, too.
ATM, Baba. Me and Davi.
Yeah. Pumi and Davi are quite, they're quite encouraged by their predictions with respect to the ATM. And listen, you both have called one or two by elections, so well done. But thank you, Davi. Pleasure to speak to you, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much. There's Davi Skoltz. You can follow him, and he's going to be working for News 24 as their elections analyst, too. How do you like that?
You know, it's absolutely fascinating for me. This election has been so wonderful to watch all of the numbers coming in and what people are saying. But the thing which we don't talk about nearly enough here in South Africa is that we're a relatively stable democracy.
Yeah.
And the thing about a stable democracy is that with time, the voter turnout tapers out because people trust that the government is kind of, you know, it's working, it's ticking along. It's the reason why Obama had to work so hard to get the Democrats to come and vote, just to come out and vote for his two elections, right? Because people in America...
Well, it's also complacency. It's just that people don't... It's not as important, you know. 1994 was a big deal because there was a lot...
But part of the complacency is because there's a general sense of this thing works... With or without me,
I don't know.
That kind. You know, even when Canton used to be here,
well,
one of the things
way,
that
Canton's,
we fought a lot
I've
about.
I've asked him to come in at 8 just so we can have a little reunion. We may just go live with that as well. but the point is that
people must go out and vote.
Well, yes and no. I mean, look, we've got serious problems. The Eskom situation being one of them.
Mm-hmm.
When people are having an experience like we have, and our economy is not growing, there is stagnation happening all around. You mentioned earlier Matamela's. We're all. What did you say? We were all languishing in his economy. Now this is not a place to be complacent. This is not a time to be complacent. And I think a lot of people should be encouraged to go out and vote. But as you and Davi have said, and you've borne each other out in the arguments that you've both given, people don't really love any of the major parties. They don't love them. So why would they get up and waste their time to go and cast a vote for a party that you're not even passionate about?
And I must say, that for me is the one thing that the IEC has failed us on in this election. Just the encourage, because that's the IEC's job, is encourage people to go out and vote, encourage people to be at the poll.
I saw interesting statistics released on young people. Let me just find this chart quickly, because I mean, obviously we don't know yet because people haven't gone to those polls yet, but this is interesting.
But it is about the number of young people, because the registrations, don't seem to be taking into account is the fact that registering to vote is about new entrants into the voter's role.
Correct.
If you and I didn't go, we just checked if we were registered, but we've been registered for years. It's the new entrance into the voter's role that we should worry about, and the fact that those 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds did not show up even to just make sure that they are on the roll.
Well, here it is, the participants drop, and basically they've compared the number of young citizens registered to vote on May 8th is lower than in prior elections. So back in 1999, there were 600,000 young people, that's aged between 18 and 19. Okay, so really, this is on the cusp, people who for the first time get to vote. 1999, it was at 600,000. In 2004, it reached an apex of around 700,000, maybe 710,000 people.
Was that you, Sia? 2004.
When were you allowed to vote for the first time, Sia?
2014.
Mm-hmm. So, okay.
Yeah,
2004 was the height, then it dropped in 2009, it dropped in 2014, and in 2019, they reckon it's below 400,000. So this would be the lowest number of young people registered to vote.
Yeah, and I think there's a direct correlation to the crappy campaign that they've got out there. I mean, who even says XA anymore?
Right.
It's a crap campaign. That's why young people don't respond to that. And that's who that campaign should be aimed at, young people, to get them to go out and
vote.
That's
still scary to me. Regardless of the campaign, it's still scary. Whether the young voters relate to the current political leaders, I still think the power that voting has should hold some regard in this light, but it doesn't to clearly a lot of people, and that's scary.
Well, Canton will be in at 8 in a little reunion. It's not part of the Burning Platform, but he's going to pop by and tell us about his little party and what's going on there. We just couldn't turn our back on him and ignore him completely now that he's gone into the political world. So he's going to pop in and talk to us just after 8. But here's something interesting. Listening to the news story about that decapitated woman whose body was found in a fridge. Now, this happened this week, right? Mm. Reminded me of an incident years ago. We had a video store in Hatfield, Pretoria, and one of our customers, a rather unassuming Dutchman, took a boarder, a craggy American cowboy. They were regulars and always friendly and chatty. They stopped coming in one day. We wondered what had happened to them. A few months later, the Dutch guy's body was found stuffed into a chest freezer in the garage. The American, it turned out, was a serial killer. He fled back to the States and was eventually arrested for the murder of 3 men. Last we heard, he was on death row. Sia, they walk among us, and sometimes they live under our roofs. Have a great day. That's from
a Dutchman and an American cowboy.
That? Yeah. How do you like that?
The killer. Say it with me, everyone.
Sia always says
the killer.
Sia says the killer lives among us. Right?
The killer doesn't care who you are, where you work, when they just have that urge. They'll just make things happen. And the killer doesn't care. The killer doesn't care whether they have a coat hanger or a chainsaw, whether they have a plastic teaspoon or they have an atomic bomb. They will kill you if they're on the mission. The killer, guys. The killer's in the traffic jam with you right now. If you're in the car, just look to your left and look to the right and realize the killer's probably in the car right next to you.
See, I'm looking to my left and I'm wondering if the killer's right here next to me. You're so passionate about this.
What I also very humbly acknowledge and accept, this is with
great humility.
Very hugely humble.
Sounds like a politician.
Is that I think we all, I don't want to sound crazy, but we all have the potential to become the killer. Should we be pushed to the corner enough? You never know what it might be. And I think there's a fine line between us being so normal and fine, we'll side-eye people, to one day being that crazy and planning a murder for 18 months.
Dude.
It's true.
Whole TV channels.
Yes.
Like, dedicated to this ish.
Oh, yes.
Like, Snapped. Uh-huh. When Wives Kill.
Yes.
But I saw one the other day, which proper, it had me like, have a little shudder, a little through like my
spine. What happened? What was it?
Killer Moms.
Killer Moms. Yeah, be careful. Watch it, children.
And we've had those moments. You know that moment?
The shake where, the baby
you,
moment.
No, where you have upset your mom so much that you look at her, and in that small moment where she's absolutely had it, you have upset her so much she is not calling you by your government names. She just has that look in her eye.
Yeah.
And you're just like,
yep.
I'm walking away.
You could kill me.
Sorry,
killer.
Mom.
The I'm killer lives away. Among us. Here's someone with Sam wants to talk about the situation with the Mr. South Africa and everything else. So Sam says, right, such bullshit. This is a quick PR recoil on the social rebrand. Ha. Men should be held to the same standards when they enter a beauty competition. Women are constantly having to put up with guys who think that they're all that and that they look shit. Well, this perpetuates that, says Sam. So if women are held...
Absolutely.
Yes. If JP wants to rebrand and as a CEO he's allowed to go for gold, then I think there's an opportunity everywhere. And this could be our moment to have Mr. Speedo South Africa. Let's just call it what it is.
Sia, you should run it.
You walk up in a Speedo.
Yeah. Sia, you should run Mr. Speedo South Africa.
Yes.
Start your own.
Display
yourself. Because if Mr. South Africa has become about who's the nicest person in the village.
I don't want that.
And the most virtuous person, I'm not interested in watching it. And neither is anybody.
So did you see
that? Not that I ever watched it before.
if you ever wanted to know if our president's finger's on the pulse.
Yes.
On the pulse.
Knows what's going on.
Tell me.
2 days ago, a statement from the presidency to welcome all the delegates for Mr. Gay World.
Oh, yes, I saw that. Wow. He was so happy.
Welcome.
Is that what he said?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It was Mr. Gay World.
It was a statement out of the presidency.
A nice message from Sam also saying happy Cliff Central Day. For yesterday, I'm happy to not have to listen to boring radio for 5 years already. I keep telling all my friends to tune in. Those who don't are missing out. Thanks for all the great content. We love you guys. That's nice. Very, very good. I mentioned Canton Pele will be popping in a little bit later on. Lots of very nice congratulations and very sweet messages from people who've been listening to us for 5 years. Some people have been listening for a little bit shorter in that time, but thank you very much. All new entries are welcome.
We didn't get to speak about this on air because it was announced on Tuesday afternoon, and of course we didn't have a show yesterday, but MultiChoice banning all Steve Hofmeyr content.
What's happened?
Let's have the energy to discuss this.
What is going on?
Discuss for 20 months. Yeah,
do we know what did Steve say, and what's the problem
again
now? I mean, I thought he was already kind of in the wilderness. I know Steve has huge support in a certain population in South Africa, but...
And they all promptly took to Twitter, like throwing their DSTV dishes and hammering
I
their...
I saw Steve Hofmeyr supporters doing that.
Like breaking
their,
stuff.
Breaking their explorers. It was all quite a display.
All right, so what did he do to get this outpouring of emotion from...
I'm sure
DSTV there's, and people who support him.
I'm sure there's an A, B, or C pick one. It can.
Yes.
He's a three-trick pony, isn't he?
Well, the Steve saga, to say the least, resurfaced a couple of weeks ago with the Afrikaans Groot Music Festival.
Oh, right, because they kicked him off their lineup, right?
Yes, okay. When... MTN, along with a bunch of other high-profile sponsors,
including
pulled
Toyota.
Out. Yeah, pulled out of the festival once Steve Hofmeyr's tweet back from 2014 resurfaced. Mm-hmm. So this is a little like Kevin Hart-esque, but I think with other people we say, oh yeah, they've changed or they've apologized. Steve is still the same old Steve. But yeah, let's... So there's no, but you know, there's no change in the past 5 years for
Steve,
him.
Steve was much more, he was much more liberal under Zuma. Funnily enough, when he was having bries with him, do you remember? He was having bries with Jacob Zuma. Now he's become very much more right wing.
He's dying on that hill.
I don't like the idea that a major media business can ban someone completely.
Yeah, it snowballed
I've never liked that idea.
It started off with DSTV being a partner for Afrikaans' Groot. And then it now evolved to them saying, DSTV, of course, which is part of MultiChoice, simply stated that Steve's views are not aligned to MultiChoice's values. And for that reason, they will remove all of Steve Hofmeyr's content on their platform.
I think they said they're no longer going to carry, like, and I think part of it, so banning, I don't know if it's banning per se, but it's more of, this guy is unpredictable. You give him a platform, you don't know what he's going to do with this platform.
Didn't we're not going to give
him our platform to spread his maliciousness. I think that's what they're saying.
But they won't even play his music videos. I don't even know. Sorry, I would quote a song, but I don't know any.
No, it's a problem. I saw a video, a series of like interviews with this guy in the States who at three different stations. You know how they have all of this reporting live on the scene, and then they ask people nearby if they. This guy has for some whatever reason, and he's an old man. He looks like he's in his 60s. He's got a gray beard and everything. But every time he stands there, like waiting to give his comments, and the minute they like put them, and it's all live, right? So he waits for the live ones, then spouts out the most atrocious kind of profanities.
I want to know who this is.
It's always the same thing. I'm going to show it to you afterwards. It's always the same thing. And you know, and I think they kind of caught on to him, and then they weren't like talking to him.
I like people like that.
It would be ab. It would be like there's an oil spill. There was a truck accident, and there's an oil spill, and then he'll start out, and he starts out like, yeah, well, I was sitting on my porch, and then I heard this loud bang, but then I. And then the network has to quickly like shut off the live broadcast and go back to the studio. And then the people in the studio are just like, oh my. Okay, well, it seems like there was a problem. And the last one is he's actually wearing a mask. It's like Halloween or something.
Okay.
So they don't know it's him.
Oh,
He's wearing a mask. So what inspired this mask of yours, whatever? And he says, well, it's all pretty strange, really. But let me show you something. And then he takes off his mask. And then he goes...
I love guys like that.
I think that's what they're trying to avoid with Steve.
Okay.
Because you never know when he's going to, like, sprout. It's like he's got some kind of, like, apartheid-type Tourette's.
Yeah.
Apartheid. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. There you go.
That defines it so well.
All right. I like it.
Birthday type Tourette's.
Before the election, I'm going to go home and read that brilliant book, Reasons to Vote ANC. You know, that one with nothing in it. The book was just the blank pages. Just so that I can be sure before I go and cast my vote. I need to do some research.
As long as you cast a vote, baby. Yeah. As long as you cast a vote.
All right. So other stuff that's going on in the news that you need to know about, Sia, anything from your side that you want to bring up this morning? We've got a bit of time before we get to Canton. Anything that's bothering you?
Yeah, well, this is interesting. Remember the big fad over the drama series 13 Reasons Why?
Yes, there was a spate of suicides as a result of that show.
Really?
Mm-hmm. That's what people are saying. So just to elaborate more on those numbers, there's been a study that has been done amongst teenagers who watched it. Oh, is the mother in you face-palming yourself, Sispumi? Are you just face-palming yourself?
You know, I told you guys about the thing about statistics and these kinds of things. It's how you ask what you ask.
Street pole analogy again?
No, the G-string.
Oh.
Yes, to the G-string. It reveals.
What it reveals is amazing, but what it hides is where you want to be.
So you don't... Do you take some such with a pinch of salt? Because they're saying there's been an additional 195 suicide deaths, which is an increase of nearly 29% among 10 to 17-year-olds in the 9 months after the series release.
Wow. Okay. Well, that might be significant.
Wow. Hmm.
It's certainly, I mean, the show, before the show existed, suicide was just not as cool.
It was still.
Yeah, and I mean, there's so many other factors. There's so many other factors. There's cyberbullying, there's social media pressures, there's just general depression.
Right.
All of those things, you know?
I have to draw attention just before we talk to him to Canton Pillay having a big fight with Nomonisa Gasa.
I saw that this Twitter. Morning.
Yo, I saw another fight. Well, it wasn't a fight.
Canton, why are you fighting with people?
I did not have a fight. I just gave her a gentle smackdown.
Yo, I saw Canton use an F-bomb at a certain reporter from The Citizen.
We're going to talk to him about the obviously the ZACP, and Canton is now the leader of a political party. But up to a couple of weeks ago, he was also just part of our show.
He says to
Nomonisa Gasa, because she says she's going to screenshot something. According to her, you've done a 360, and she's going to archive this screen grab. So Canton replies, "No need. I never delete my tweets. I have 30-plus years of writing archived at CantonPillay.com, and many of my views have evolved. You still support the ANC. I no longer do. One of us has grown up."
Ooh. But 360 also means you're in the same spot.
Well, I thought it best not to point that out. Everyone who climbed in has given her a smackdown and said, "This is the result of ANC's maths literature." Maths literacy. Confession time, by the way. I actually own a Steve Hoffmeyer record.
You do?
I do.
Really?
I do.
Which one?
It's the Blue Bulls theme.
Oh, God. That's a... Oh, really?
Yeah. Dion Duplessis was one of my dearest friends.
What?
And, he's dead now.
Okay. I just want to know.
Yeah. And And he was a Blue Bulls fan, and
that's that De Blow Bull.
And it's pretty thumping.
I used to play that at Loftus on the two occasions I was there.
It's pretty thumping.
All right.
But do you still have a CD player?
I still have tech going back to way before you were born,
record players.
I have a wire recorder. Have you even heard of such a thing?
A wire recorder?
Yes.
What is that?
Well, before we recorded things onto magnetic tape, we recorded things onto wire. You did not know that such a thing was possible.
No, I had no idea.
In 1955, my parents did a Tamil classical performance on what was then the English service of Radio South Africa.
Yeah?
And that was recorded on wire, which I still have.
Unbelievable. My God.
I'm struggling to even picture what this...
What does this technology look like?
Well, just kind of picture a tape recorder, except you thread a wire through it rather than tape, because the wire is magnetized.
What's the wire made of?
Steel, I assume.
It records it onto the steel.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because it's essentially, the way in which tape works is that there's iron oxide filings.
Sure.
Which are magnetized.
And then it plays out by electronic signal, whatever's on the tape. Okay, very good.
It's the reason why we use the phrase "on the wire."
There we go.
I don't think so. I think that comes from telegraph.
Yeah, but it's because of the wire.
No, that comes from the telegraph. That doesn't come from...
All right, Canton. everybody's very excited about the elections last week. We just spoke to Darby Skultz. I know, it's next week already.
Not last week.
It's next week. Did I say last week?
Yes.
Next week. On Wednesday next week, we go vote. You go and vote. And if you're not registered, obviously, it's too late for you. But you can go and place your vote, as Darby Skultz said just now, for one of the major parties. He doesn't think the small party is going to make a difference. This is an argument that keeps coming up. You get asked this all the time. Why would people want to waste their time on you or Bantu Hulumisa or Masuele Kota or the ACDP? What's your standard answer to this?
Well, we'll only know whether we're a small party after the election. So it's
because there's no data on you at the moment.
There's no data on us.
So in other words, you haven't taken part in any by-elections, so there's no way for them to get a reading on whether or not you guys are strong or weak or in between.
Exactly right. But if you have to take social media mentions as the metric, objective, as the metric, I think that we're pretty much trouncing all of the other purportedly small parties.
Now, one thing I've noticed about you guys is that there seem to be a lot of people who have become interested in the election because they're single-issue voters. So maybe they're interested in, free markets, or they're interested in gun ownership or any of these things.
Free speech, yeah.
Free speech. Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are things that we haven't really ever had in South Africa.
I know, isn't it great?
Well, yeah, I think it gives people options. Absolutely. This is about the evolution of democracy. But in America, for example, there are a lot of single-issue voters. There are people who will only go to the polls because of abortion or gun ownership or free speech or any of these other things that are massively important in the American society.
Well, lots of people have been piling into us around the abortion thing. And my stock response to that is...
What is your position, this ZACP position?
Well, we don't have a ZACP position because the Constitutional Court has already declared that, you know, the right to abortion is constitutional.
Mm-hmm.
My personal position is I'm pro-choice.
Yeah.
But, you know, for me, it's a non-issue. It's not something that's going to...
So why would people be piling into you?
Well, because...
Seems uncontroversial.
Yeah, because for some reason, you know, people want to make that the reason why they end up voting for parties. So the ACDP, for example,
yeah,
very clearly is
pro-life.
Anti-abortion.
Yeah.
Well, I refuse to use that phrase, pro-life.
That's what they call it. I'm just using their language.
What a propaganda coup that is, calling it pro-life. I call it anti-choice. Let's just call
okay.
it that.
All right. Okay. All right.
Anti-choice.
Yeah. Because, I mean, it's this whole thing, you know, life begins at conception and ends at birth. Because, you know, once a kid's born, you toss it out in the street. You actually don't give, well, anyway,
yeah.
Let's move on. No F-bombs this morning.
All right. What are the issues that your voters are coming up with?
Free speech,
are they most interested in?
Look, free speech is big up there. EWC is certainly big up there. Affirmative uh-huh. action is huge. And guns.
Okay. Now, you've promised something which seems like a fairly big deal. You've said you want to, in property, you want to change the way that property in this country is viewed. You want to make sure that by 2020, 20 million people own property?
Yes.
Is that possible?
Absolutely, it's possible.
How? I mean, you're a very pragmatic guy. Every time you've come on the Burning Platform, people have said, what we like about Canton is he has real-world solutions, and you're not interested in talking about theory.
Well, I basically got tired of all of the stuff that kept coming out from particularly the ANC supporters and from the EFF supporters and, of course, BLF, mm-hmm. around how important it was to, you know, turn land over to people. And I just started crunching some numbers.
Okay.
So there are a bunch of broad categories in terms of availability of land that people currently already have access to. So the first broad category is RDP housing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look in terms of the rollout that has happened in terms of RDP housing, there's been fairly substantial number that have been rolled out over
you
the
past. You can see them.
Years.
I mean, you could drive around most of the metros,
for sure,
and you'll
yeah.
see a lot of housing's been
built. So there's RDP housing, plus there's state-subsidized housing, which is basically rental properties and so forth. And we did a calculation of the total number of those properties.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes to 7,058,502
properties
that are RDP properties,
okay,
or state subsidized properties. So in other words, they are properties that are owned. Well, actually, I should clarify as well that this the 7 million that we're talking about are those they exclude where title deeds have been handed over to RDP owners.
Okay, exclude.
So they exclude, right? Okay. Okay. So in
so
other
who
words,
who owns these 7 million properties?
The state does.
Oh.
Well, and you see, the RDP houses technically have been allocated to people for handing over. However, there's a backlog in terms of the state actually making title deeds available.
Okay.
But so if you take into account RDP houses where no title deeds have been handed over, and you take into account all of the state-subsidized housing and rental properties,
mm-hmm.
that comes to a total of 7,058,502.
So that's a lot of properties.
That's a lot of properties. And basically what we are saying is that hand over every single one of those properties to the people that they have been allocated to immediately. Mm-hmm. Just give it to them. The idea of the state being a landlord is absurd.
Mm-hmm.
Just hand the properties over, give people the title deeds, and fast-track the process of actually ensuring that the transfer goes through so that people are able to say, I am now a property owner, I actually have this piece
that
of
That would
ground.
Immediately make 7 million odd people, and probably more if you consider that a lot of these properties would be owned by families, that would make them property owners, that would make them participants in the economy where they can borrow against that, all kinds of things.
Absolutely. So, yeah.
They could start a little business, you know, because they've got fixed property.
We've spoken about that on the Burning platform before. That, you know, the shortcut to actually making people.
So whose interest is it to keep this property in the hands of the state?
Well, again, it goes back to the incompetence of the state, because allocation of resources to the actual process of handing over the title deeds is something that doesn't actually happen. Now, you know that I've supported the Free Market Foundation for years, and the Free Market Foundation did this exercise out near Paris, where what they did was they took the informal settlements out there, and they basically went through the process of legally demarcating the land and drawing up title deeds and handing them over, and they call for sponsorship for people to hand over to basically sponsor someone becoming a property owner. So I contributed to that back then. I think they were asking for about 1,400 rand per household for people to donate in order to make someone a property owner. And
how's that gone?
Fantastically well. I wrote a piece on it. Check kanthanpalay.com and just search for
Wade through the 30 years
of archives.
Wade through the 30 years. Yeah, just search for Paris, and because obviously I don't write about Paris that often. Search for Paris and you'll find it. But that's a very specific example, and that township is now booming. Okay, what's happened is people have now been able to, well, in the first place, that means that they've been able to sell their property and move elsewhere. Because one of the issues right now with RDP housing, okay, let's say you have someone who was allocated an RDP house 15 years ago and they're now retired. But they want to now move to, you know, maybe the place of their birth as an example.
Yes.
And
they can't get rid of it because they have no document to show that it's there.
Yes, exactly.
So if they vacate or they sell,
or pass
someone
it on
else
to
could
their
make
kids
a claim.
Or whatever, you know, come to... or even rent it out. So that's 7 million that we've got so far.
Okay, Captain, I have a burning question that I think you're the only person that can answer for any of us. Now that you're on the other side of the table.
Yes.
You've started a political party.
We'll get back to your 20 million houses in a minute.
Yeah. It's on the manifesto.
That you love reading.
What has your experience been like with the electorate, and also because you're on social media, with the media, in terms of now that you're no longer just an active citizen, now you are a political party leader? Mm-hmm. What's the difference? What have you learned from this experience?
Look, I've kind of been on the other side before, because I spent a brief period in my career being a spin doctor. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the ability to actually work well with the media across the board was, you know, an utterly crucial skill. And I'd like to think that I did that extremely well. And, you know, I certainly don't have anything to complain about in terms of how media as a whole has been treating me. I think, by and large, if you take a look at the coverage that ZACP has been getting from the mainstream media, it's been extremely fair, you know. And I think that we've actually gotten a disproportionate amount of coverage just simply based on the fact that we're interesting. You know, that we're not just saying, you know, jobs for all and land for all. We're actually saying, hey, guys, we've got these solutions. And, you know, for some reason, when you come up with something that's interesting, people want to write about it. From the point of view of engaging with members of the public on social media, a lot of people, when they discovered that I was no longer part of the old guard that used to support the ANC back in the day, turned on me with a substantial amount of vitriol. And I found that quite interesting, just on the basis that, you know, one would think that people actually have more nuance in their life.
I was curious. I saw Daniel Friedman from The Citizen sent you a message on WhatsApp to say, please would you comment on this story? And you said, no, really, you're too busy electioneering. You don't have time to comment on the story. He then replied to say, well, then he's going to tell people that you don't have a comment on this and that you couldn't be reached for comment. And you said, well, actually, you can say, Canton Pillay doesn't give a fuck.
That was an appropriate move. Well, but it's true.
What? Just bring us into your thinking here.
Well, you see, right now, a lot of the issues that people have around politics is they try to distract politicians by doing a whole lot of whataboutery. So, you know, Trump makes a comment about something that goes down in Venezuela, but he doesn't make a comment on what goes down in
Sri Lanka
as an example. And then people kind of pile into him and they say, why has he been silent on this particular thing? Now, the fact is that if we spend our time commenting on every single thing that happens in the world, that's utterly irrelevant to what we're trying to do to fix the country. When would things actually happen? So our energy really has been focused on coming up with solutions. Like, I mean, number crunching around how we create 20 million property owners.
All right.
That's something serious.
Let's get back to that for a second. So you've taken care of 7 million if you give these title deeds to people who currently are in possession or have been promised and allocated an RDP house or a government leased housing subsidy.
Sure.
So now that's 7 million. That still leaves you with another 13 million to deal with by 2020.
Yes.
How are you going to get there?
Bantustans, homelands.
Yeah. What about them?
You see, the myth up until now is that people have been saying for the longest time, you can't just allocate property rights in the former Bantustans and the former homelands because of the fact that they've never actually been documented. You know, most of urban society is divided into urban, you know, the plural of earth, and which, you know, so you'll have a portion of a lot or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. But there has been a very specific system by which all of the land in the formal economy has actually been divided up, and you know precisely where everyone's property boundaries are and all of that kind of thing. But that has never actually been done in the former homelands because there's no private property in those spaces. So for the longest time, every time you raise the question of give people property rights, the response is always, well, these places have never been properly designated. Well, guess what?
You can.
We actually have data that government has access to as well that very specifically drills down into exactly where every dwelling unit, they refer to them as dwelling frame units, is located in every single former Bantustan, former homeland in the country.
All right.
And we know precisely where they are.
So hard work's been done.
Yes, all the hard work has been done, and we have exact geographic locations in terms of every single one of those properties. And
in order to constitute a piece of property, you need to have a designated space mapped out.
And we're saying, well, the question about who has responsibility for the land surrounding the properties can continue to reside with the traditional authorities.
Mm-hmm.
However, the actual physical dwelling, give people title deeds to that immediately. And the exact data that we have in terms of all of those properties is 13,991,168 properties. And if you add up that 13,991,000 plus the 7,058,000, we actually get to 21 million houses. And I am saying that given that we have the data in place exactly, all we have to do at this point is to actually assign every single one of those geographic locations to the family that actually occupies that. And hey presto, you've got property owners.
Hmm. Who's against this?
I would assume that it would be the traditional leaders who would be against it. And they would be against it right now because they are essentially, you know, lords and masters of all their survey. And
it's like feudal.
Yes, it's completely feudal. Mm. And I'm saying, look, you know, by all means, keep your traditional what-whats and control of the surrounding lands.
Mm-hmm.
But let's give security of tenure to the people who physically occupy those properties. Because what that then means is that someone who suddenly has a house there, they can then start improving that because they know it's not going to be taken away from them.
Mm. Yeah, and they'll have the ability to list it as an asset.
Exactly.
This is the first purpose of anyone who wants to start growing their own personal economy, let alone the economy of the region, the area, the country. This could have enormous implications.
Exactly.
So that stuff at the moment doesn't belong to anyone.
Well, it actually belongs to, well, in the case of KZN, it
belongs to King Goodwill Zwelithini.
Yes, it belongs to.
And it shouldn't.
Well, you know, I think that you're going to run up against the traditionalists who are going to tell you, oh, you know, historically the king has been responsible. And I'm saying that's fine. You know, you can have discussions around who owns the surrounding land on which the property is actually situated. But right now, there's absolutely no reason why the homes themselves, you know, the exact geographic location, and I don't know if I sent you guys this press release where I was talking about, and I used Nkandla as a very specific example. You know, we can drill down into Nkandla itself, and I used the very specific example in terms of that municipality. I must tell you, by the way, the data sets that actually map all of these locations run into terabytes. Wow, there's a substantial amount of
huge
data.
Amount of work that's been done.
Yes,
actually,
massive
for what?
Well, because remember that we need to...
These are surveyors, right?
Stats SA collects this data. It's needed for census.
Right.
So a lot of this information traces itself back directly to the census. And so just in Kandla by itself, there's 114,408 people living in the Kandla local municipality. 27,665 dwelling frames under the control of 15 tribal authorities, which in turn fall under 142 main places and 213 small areas. We've got absolutely drilled down with precision down to every single house, and you can zoom in on the pictures and see exactly where every household is. If you take a look at that,
amazing.
Every red dot represents the actual location of a physical house.
So, Pumi, your thoughts on this?
What would it take to make that happen? So, if
it takes will on the part of government to actually mm-hmm. make it happen. The first thing that you do is to actually pass a law that says right now, if you happen to be the resident in one of those households, then you have 10 years. So just that is the starting point. Just pass that law. And so just let that be the starting point. Then the process of documentation.
You make almost a third of the people in this country legal landowners of their own possession in terms of property.
Well, more than a third, yes. We're talking 20 million people.
That's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, but to pass a law, there are quite a couple of steps that come before having the law signed by the president.
Well, it requires will on the part of the state. And obviously we're going to start really campaigning for this to be done as a matter of urgency. And essentially the state has to come up with compelling reasons as to why it cannot be done. You see, what they've pushed up until now is that the process is so onerous that they'd never be able to get it out of the way. And now that is clearly a lie. So now that we've established that they have access to the data and they know exactly where these places are, all they have to do is just simply pass the law to start off with that says that you've now got security of tenure in these places, and then the process of documentation can then start. And I'm saying put that out to tender. I'm pretty sure that a combination of Google Maps and the Israelis will very quickly turn it into something practical that can then drill down into biometrics of people who are associated with that particular household.
And this would also count for townships.
Yes.
I mean, essentially, if you've been in possession and you and your family have been in a certain dwelling in a township for X amount of time, that's the strongest claim there is.
Well, that's pretty much a given. Herman Mashaba has been doing a lot of that already, where he's basically been handing over title deeds en masse to people who are living in the municipalities. So I think that process is...
embarrassment that the ANC haven't come up with this idea themselves.
Well, I mean, the reason why they haven't is because they want the tribal authorities to continue to be existing in the way that they have right now, because that basically becomes a power structure. And if they happen to not like the particular tribal authority, in the case of Dalin Yebo, they put him in jail.
Wow. This is quite a big deal. This is seismic. I mean, this could be the most important thing in your election manifesto. This could be the most important thing in your promise.
Well, we've got more interesting things coming next week as well.
All right. Purple cow continues to stampede into.
Yeah, we'll be having a town hall meeting about this at 12:30 to chat about it too.
Very good.
To the masses.
You can follow Canthan for more on Twitter. You can find him at Canthan Pillay. And you can also look for the purple cow. There are a lot of them. I've seen a lot of people changing their icon to purple cows.
Awesome, isn't it?
Yeah, and I've seen lots of different kinds of purple cows too, with their horns in different positions. And I think people like it.
Yeah.
It's very clever. That is a clever logo. It's very smart work.
Could I have a last word on Steve Hoffmeyer?
Oh, of course. Yes, go ahead.
Well, you see, my view on every media organization, and let's take, you know, Cliff Central as an example.
Mm-hmm.
I've no doubt that there are particular people that you would never want on your platform. For whatever reason, you know, we're not going to go into the details. No, wait,
I'll say that I'm not sure about that because we've had Andy Lemkitama and we've had Steve Hoffmeyer.
I'm not talking about from a political point of view, but I'm just talking from the perspective that just in terms of your business values and all of that kind of stuff.
I'm not going to give Adolf Hitler a show. Yeah.
Well, whatever. But what I'm trying to say is that every media organization has that list of people that they will just put to the side and they'd never consider bringing them on. The issue right now in terms of Steve Hoffmeyer is that all they had to do was just to issue an internal memo that says, guys, in future we will not be engaging with this.
Instead, they made it about virtue
signaling. Now it is virtue signaling. And what a public relations disaster that is. Because, you know, immediately it opens up a can of worms in terms of the constitutionality of what they are doing. You know, I think that there's a very strong possibility that, you know, public interest groups like AfriForum will now turn around and say, we actually need to launch a legal challenge against this this thing.
Instead of just quietly letting it be the
exactly.
policy.
Yeah. You know, when I was running ETV News, I had what was called a shit list.
Mm.
And, you know, it was common course. You know, all of the staff knew about it.
The SABC had one of those, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right. You know, people on the shit list don't get on. I mean, you know, obviously my criteria for the shit list were very different from the SABC's criteria for the shit
list. But is this the result of woke people being put into positions of authority?
I have no idea what their marketing department was thinking.
It's because everybody is so in love with being famous. Everybody wants to be seen and like applauded and loved for the things that they're famous for being famous. That's, so when you do something, you want everybody to know about it.
You're wearing purple glasses.
I've always had my purple glasses.
Oh, goodness.
I just saw them now and thought that looks remarkably like the color on Canton's t-shirt. All right, very
good. But like I said, you know, from a virtue signaling point of view, I think it's a public relations disaster. I think, you know, whoever in their marketing department came up with the thought that this was a good thing to do, they really need their heads read. Because, you know, frankly, the only thing that DSTV offers right now that no one else does is Super Sport. And
and then Mzansi Magic. My goodness, what will people do without Date My Family?
I've been without DSTV now for about 7 years.
Wow.
You mean you've never seen The River?
No. He doesn't even know what that is. He's completely confused. All right, everybody. Thank you very much. Canton, good luck with 20 million houses by 2020. That's a very audacious promise, but he's given us the details of how he's going to make it happen. Well, if you can make it happen. I mean, listen, it's going to need more than just you.
Yes, I know. But, you know, trust me, we're going to be banging on that drum.
Very good.
Every opportunity in Parliament.
That is Canton Pillay. And Pumi Mashiko and Sia Sangweni and me, we will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. Have an excellent day in the company of CliffCentral.com. Be good if you're not, take photos.
This is CliffCentral.com.